Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Conservation Stories. This is a podcast brought to you by the Sandhill Area Research Association, SARA, as we like to call it. I'm your host, Hillary Timmons-Sims, and I am joined today by Ben Samuels. Ben works with the produced water, which we've had a couple of podcasts on produced water before, but I'm really excited for Ben to be here because this is going to be more of an international look at this topic and deep dive into some of the policies and issues that are coming up. So, Ben, thank you so much for coming.
Absolutely. Appreciate the time. Appreciate you giving me the opportunity to join you today.
Well, and the nice thing is Ben's actually here in studio with us. We don't usually get to see people face-to-face, so that is really nice. Thanks for coming in from Midland, correct?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, Midland. I've been out there for about 11 years now, and I'm trying to buck the trend of everything being on Zoom. Wanted to sit here so in studio face-to-face, and think it's a fundamentally different feel.
So. It really is. It really is. Thanks for being here. Well, can you give us a little bit of your background and tell us how you got involved with produced water? And so if people will probably remember that produced water is the water that we kind of call the new water that's being produced out of oil and gas production, lots of that.
Absolutely. It's become a really hot button issue, and it's really, there's a lot more focus on it than there has been in years past. By way of sort of introduction to myself, born and raised in Houston, went to undergrad in Boston, and then really deciding what industry and where I wanted to be. I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur, knew I wanted to be in an industry that was dynamic and had a lot of different touch points. And so oil and gas was a natural fit for that. And so back in 2014, went and got a post BA in professional land and resource management. And then I've had boots on the ground out in Midland ever since, April of 2014. Started my career on the mineral side of the business, so on the subsurface. And so I got a really good sense of those deals and how those are put together, those contracts. And the reason I bring up contracts is because as we talk about produced water, more and more in this conversation, it really comes back to those contracts, how they're written. And there were a lot of those contracts and oil and gas leases that when they were written, they had no conception of that water was going to be as important as it is. And those minerals in that water were going to be as important as they are today and as they're going to continue to be in the near term. That also sort of leads me into the career trajectory and transition. I spent about 4 or 5 years in minerals, doing transactional work on behalf of a couple of private equity shops and some family offices. And back in 2017, 2018, I started to become a lot more interested and focused on the water and the surface side of the business because of some of those reasons, because it was becoming more and more of an issue, more and more of a topic of conversation.
Right, and you're entrepreneurial. And so people that think like entrepreneurs, they see stuff. They see it before other people see it coming.
Try and always stay ahead of the curve,
yes,
right?
Ahead of the game, exactly.
And so, I started doing more work on that side, and that started with advisory with some ranchers, and that was everything from beneficial reuse initiatives to how can we use the land that is available to the best of our abilities. Mm-hmm, I think I'll briefly pause and talk about land stewardship because I think that really is the backbone of a lot of the things that I do now, and a lot of the things or a lot of the ways that I think about these things.
Yeah.
But I think there may be a little bit of a misnomer around what stewardship is, in the sense that I'm a strong believer that we need to be looking at the natural resources and looking at the processes that we're employing to develop those natural resources in a way that future generations can take use of that and appreciate that. But at the same time, I think there's an important distinction of making sure that our processes and the strategies that we're employing today are actually beneficial for the stakeholders today. And I think that there's sometimes when you bring in all the stakeholders, you bring in the EPA, you bring in local government, you bring in landowners, you bring in surface owners, you bring in mineral owners, and then you talk about operators. And there's a lot of people in that building that all need to be treated fairly. How do you really go about crafting policies around these things when, and I'll pause here because I know that I'm saying a lot and I want to hear your thoughts as well, but I think all those policies and all those initiatives right now are backed up by things like the Colorado River Compact that is back in the 1920s. And you have a lot of these policies and initiatives that when they were put in place, they had really good impetus and they were put in for the right reasons. But if we're still using those policies to manage and govern our water 100 years later, that invites a whole firestorm bucket of issues that you and I think we've talked about offline as well. And so I'll kind of stop there, you know, in deference and wanting to dig into any piece of that. But those are some of the things that I think about when coming to the table. Like,
no, it's so true. And, you know, I always think that the middle is usually right kind of where the truth is, and it's the hardest place to find. You know, and keeping that balance on both sides is so vital. And I think that's why for so many years here in our culture, people have been reluctant to be part of anything that would be considered environmental, is because environmentalism kind of, you know, was started off way one way. It's, and I'm seeing it swing more towards the middle. Recently, I heard someone from the Environmental Defense Fund say something in a meeting about farm economics that was actually correct. And I went up to him and said, I'm really confused. You're from the Environmental Defense Fund. And he said, no, I'm an ag economist, like an A&M ag economist, and hired by them. And, you know, later on had a conversation with one of the Environmental Defense Fund's upper staff about just how shocked I was. And they said, we've made a lot of mistakes. We've made a lot of mistakes, you know, because when you harm your current stakeholders, you're really not going to get anywhere. And, you know, I'm wearing today the shirt, you know, Mike's quote that says nobody, you know, he still prefaces, nobody understands what sustainability is, but stewardship is. You know, makes us responsible. It's a verb. It makes us responsible. And I was digging into that, like, why does no one know what that means, sustainability? I mean, I understood, you know, quickly, you know, in this space that if a company was asking a farmer to do something that was sustainable for the company, if it wasn't economically sustainable for the farm, it's worthless. It's not, it can't be sustained. And so, and you probably already aware, but that whole concept of sustainability started out of an economic method in the 90s that looked at that Venn diagram of where people, planet, and profit overlap. And that overlap is sustainability. And that, I think, is what you're getting to, which is we have to consider the present and the future.
Absolutely. You know, I think when you say that, some of the things that percolate to the top of mind for me are, you know, we still live in a country where we are incentivizing large swaths of acreage that's owned and operated by farmers not to farm, not to plant crop, because there's political ramifications of that, but there's also, you need to, you know, regenerate the soil. And mm-hmm. there's things, as an example, I think there's a lot more alfalfa being planted out in the country right now because that plant takes the nitrogen out of the air and puts it back in the soil. But when you're doing that, if that land has been cotton or corn in the past, you're not producing those other crops,
right?
And so
right.
You know, then you start mm-hmm. to talk about, you know, the availability of the crop, mm-hmm. but also mm-hmm. going back to water, alfalfa is uses substantively less water than something, you know, something else that may take in its place. And so I think, again, going back to the water, you know, when you talk about a state by state issue, Texas is a right to capture state. You have Colorado, that's a riparian right state. And so you have all of these other, how are we managing the water? How are we allocating the water? And again, going back to the Colorado River Compact, which I think is a defining document in mm-hmm. the water mm-hmm. management in this country, mm-hmm. how today are we defining reasonable use? And how is the reasonable use definition we're using today in practical terms different than it was when those words were written into the compact 100 years ago?
Yeah,
and I think
exactly.
That's sort of an easy thing to say, mm-hmm. but when you talk about the water management and you talk about water scarcity issues and you talk about stewardship, you really have to start at the basics. You really have to start with those definitions, because if those definitions have fundamentally changed over the last 100 years, but they're still governing the water body the exact same way, you automatically have a divergence,
right.
in whether
right.
it be impetus or incentives, et cetera. And, mm-hmm. and something I think about a lot, again, going back to the stewardship, is all the stakeholders what we're talking about, unless there's aligned incentives across all
right.
of those stakeholders, you're really never going to get anywhere. You might get some iterative improvements, but you're really never going to take those quantum leaps forward that we need.
Right, and that, you know, you may know that we helped Milestone Environmental Services recently on just bringing awareness to how our energy waste regulations in Texas haven't been updated since the 80s, you know, and that's another example, you know, of how, but it is another example of also saying, how do you do this without hurting stakeholders? And apparently there were a few stakeholders that were like, this is going to be too harmful to us. So then surely there's a solution, you know, and there is, which would be probably to just give them an out on some of those things. You know, you used a word earlier, nuance, and I think it was before we started recording because we were discussing the recent Texas monthly article on PFAS and chemicals and how often those articles don't get into the nuance of those issues. And it's difficult. People want there to be clearly defined black and white, and so often our issues are gray, and that makes people really uncomfortable because that gray means that there's truth on both sides, and that creates an ambivalence that makes people really uncomfortable. You know, how do we address that? You have any ideas on, like, how do we begin to, like, make that information available in a way that people want to listen? Because it seems like now, if you're not writing something or presenting something in a way that emotionally upsets people, there's so many other things that are louder.
Absolutely. And I think it's a really difficult challenge because, you know, we live in a world of what I like to kind of think of like goldfish attention. You know, we have fleeting attention on things that are very important and the important issues. Mm-hmm. And until it's in our backyard, until we can see it, touch it, feel it, I don't think that people really realize it's an issue. And to compound that, I think the oil and gas industry is even worse at that. I think we have a tendency to, unless there's a problem that we can see the fire and the hot fire is hot and the fire is growing, we can put it off till tomorrow. And I think we are waking up to a world where that we have to act because we are now at the place where unless we act, we're going to fundamentally see things start to break at the seams. And we really have already seen that. If you look at the water levels in Lake Powell, if you look at the, you know, Arizona, in wide swaths of Arizona, they have started to tell developers, real estate developers, you cannot build that subdivision because that subdivision will not have enough water to it. You know, in Texas, I don't know the number at current, but in recent years, there has been over 30% less water flow to the Rio Grande from places like the Pecos River and the Colorado River and things of that nature are, you know, in the short term, okay, we have some stop gaps. We can figure it out on the iterative basis. We might be able to get through this year. But if those trends continue to happen and compound each other, you wake up with a problem that you're now way behind the eight ball.
Absolutely. And I've been reading through a book called Cadillac Desert. Have you read this book?
I have not yet, no.
Oh, my goodness. It is, I mean, it's kind of scathing in some ways, you know what I mean? But just, you know, his basic thesis is, you know, hey, now, here we've been trying to desert, you know, to like green a desert. And we're kind of reaching the limits of what we can do. He talks about these regulations that you're talking about, like all the things that were put in place to make water available to the west side of the country where it wasn't necessarily available. The cost, the corruption that went into all of that, and some of it, you know, we're just paying the price for now. It takes a lot of leadership, and I feel like that's not something necessarily that we see a lot. I know I'm super impressed with New Mexico's water plan. That is like, it's answering the immediate need and what they're doing now will get them 40 years down the road. And then they have something coming even by that time, something else is coming in. And it is a deep solution. Does that make sense? Like, you know, it's not just thinking like we're going to provide for tomorrow or we're going to skip 40 years and then we'll have a solution.
Absolutely. I think it's really critically important to have that roadmap because with the roadmap, you can have the check and balance of where are we on the roadmap, and you can make pivots, you know, as needed. You know, I think there are some states, Texas being one of them, that are sort of adopting the hair on fire method, as I like to call it. Okay, well, you know, we're going to fix today's problem, and we'll fix tomorrow's problem tomorrow.
Right.
And I think that that's a potentially disastrous way to approach because one of the cases that I think about that I don't think gets nearly enough attention, and I'm going to mess up the exact case, but it was the case between Texas, New Mexico, and the Fed related to the Elephant Butte Reservoir. And this was back, I think this was 2016, 2017, give or take. And very long story short, Texas asked New Mexico to withhold a significant portion of their allocation of water because their reservoirs at the time were overflowing. They needed some diversion. They made a deal, and part of this flowed through some federal waters, and so the federal government was involved as well. They made a deal. Long story short, Texas ended up calling on that water years down the road, and there had been so much evaporation from that water that New Mexico said, okay, well, here's the water you have left. And again, without going in too much in the details, there was about 65 to 70% of the water that Texas was expecting in that resource. And Texas went to New Mexico, is like, hey, where's the rest of it? Well, it evaporated. Who is responsible for that water? And I know that seems like such a minutia detail and something that, oh, well, you know, that doesn't happen often enough for it to be. But I think it paints the picture of, again, sort of the management on and the regulation side of this. You really have to think years and years and years in advance, because if you're not, you're going to wake up one day. And I mean, I remember going to California as a kid, and you know, I'm mid-30s, and you know, when I was a kid, they were having times where you had to shut off water, you couldn't use the water, and they were having restrictions on lawn use for water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we're now 25 years in the future. I know California is still doing that, but what other states are doing that? And the last thing I'll say before hand it back off to you is I think at the backbone of a lot of the things that we're talking about is, I think we live in a world, and we live in a, certainly in this country, we live in a society where water is treated as this ubiquitous resource that will be there at any time I want, wherever I need it, at any, you know, at any level I need it, etc. And that's just not reality. We don't live in that world. And the people that are on like the water side of the industry understand that. I think one of the major problems that our country is facing, to put it very simply, is we have enough water point blank in the country for everyone. But we certainly do not have enough water where it needs to be, when it needs to be, at the places to be given to the people that need it.
Right, right. And we have not had the forethought to think of, like Arizona saying, no, you can't put housing there. There is always a coordinating weakness to every strength that we have, and part of that, the weakness to, conservative people, we're conservative, we're going to conserve money in the state of Texas, but the coordinating weakness to that is sometimes we wait too long to spend that money. And then we have a big problem that we're having to fix, where if we had been working on it all along, that also that we have that great strength of, leaning into people and less government, but sometimes people have to be made to do stuff because we won't necessarily always do the right thing, nor will corporations always do the right thing. So there always has to be a balance, and really what you're talking about is something that, when you're talking about water regulations, that Senator Perry mentioned to me not long ago, was that, is there not an agency that's looking at every single water policy in every single state affecting every single river that we can go to? Because so the state of Texas goes to Mississippi, or I'm sorry, to Louisiana, and says, we want your water. Well, so have five other states, And so who's keeping track of who all is going to get, Louisiana might know, but is there someone above them that needs to know as well? So we've gotten we are not even talking about produced water yet.
I know.
But this has been so good. I'm like, I appreciate your perspective because it really, really meshes well with what we see.
I mean, and I think the other piece that I'd add to that is, again, going back to the regulation, and I'm not going to prognosticate about how to fix this or how to backpedal, but I will tell you that we currently live in a market, and we live in a world where, let's say, landowner Ted wants to sell water. He lives in Texas. He lives on the Texas-New Mexico border, and he wants to sell water to his farming neighbor on the other side of the state line. He's not able to do that. It's not like he wants to, or you have to come up with a good price. You're not able to send water across state lines in most instances, and that's across the country. That's not just Texas. I mean, you pick a state. They really, that water is meant for that state, and I think, when you start to talk about moving water to where it needs to be and the volumes it needs to be, et cetera, you need a more fleshed out water market. Currently, there are states that have water markets that are actually truly defining water as a resource and have a monetary value, but most of the country is not doing that.
Right, right. I think New Mexico, right, they have something that's going to be going to the legislature this year.
Hopefully.
So, yes, we hope so. But so produced water is water, but it's a whole different animal. It's a whole different animal. So give us a quick, short, little What is produced water?
So produced water, at its very basic definition, is the water that is produced alongside the oil and gas in the production process of oil and gas. If you're in the business, you probably have a much better perspective on this, but there is a significant amount of water that's needed to drill wells that, mm-hmm. that goes downhole along with the drilling equipment to drill the well, but there's a massive amount of water that comes out of the well during production and through the life of that well. There are places in the Permian Basin where at the initial steps of production, you're looking at a water cut. So for every barrel of oil and gas, there's 3 to 5 barrels of this water. Other places or down the life of a well when it's a little bit older, that split maybe as much as 8 to 12 to 1. And so for every million barrels of oil produced, you have 12 million barrels of water that something needs to be done with it, because it's not at a spec or it's not at a
it's not clean, it's not ready to be used,
right? It's not at a level where you can really do much mm-hmm. of anything with it. There are mm-hmm. processes in place now where there are places that are in their pilot programs where you can use some of that water on non-potable ag, and what I mean by that is it's ag products you're not eating, so that's cotton, hay, some of those other things. There are billions of gallons of water every mm-hmm, year mm-hmm. that we currently mm-hmm. have no productive use for, and so some of that stuff ends up back downhole into the formation.
Some of it, most of it, a lot of it.
A lot of it. Absolutely. I would say a vast majority of it ends up downhole, either through a reinjection into that well or through a saltwater disposal well and things of that nature. But you're starting to see, I think it goes back to what we were talking about. You're starting to see people wake up to this issue that we have. We've had increased seismicity out in the Permian Basin. That has become a larger and larger issue. But at the same time, going back to the stakeholders involved, if you're a farmer and you've been farming cotton on your land for 60 years and you were used to making, enough money to get by, you weren't wealthy by any means, but you weren't wanting for anything in life. And then water came in the picture and you started selling fresh water to oil and gas operators. And now you're making, 7 or 8 figures a year. Mm. If the right thing to do, if the responsible thing to do is for you to say, okay, well, industry, I'm no longer selling you any water. As the landowner, are you really principled enough to make that decision? Right. That also means that the money spigot's being turned off. And I think that those are some of the realities of the conversation that may not be getting as much attention.
That's interesting.
As they need, because again, this is a, everybody's at the table here.
Right.
Everyone has something to gain, but everybody's got something to lose as well. And I think that, there's something in the middle.
So at several of the meetings we've been at, we'll see, the usage, who's using the water. And usually, irrigation's way up there, like 80%. But I've been surprised at how either sometimes it's like, we don't really know how much oil is using. And I think, how can we not know that? Surely we know that, Or it's like so significantly low that I go, I feel like it must be more than that. But it doesn't, like, the significance of it seems less. I mean, when I see it up on the numbers and then I know enough about oil and gas, I think, I feel like oil and gas is using more water than that. But is it because so much of our new produced water is being recycled and reused?
I'm going to try to answer that question succinctly, because that's a really detailed question that I could really peel the onion back on. But I think the thing that I focus on the most when I hear that is, I'll paint a specific example. Up until about 4 or 5 years ago, there had not been a comprehensive study of the Colorado River to understand where that water was actually being sent. There wasn't a good sense of how much volume there was. There wasn't a good sense on where it was being sent. And one of the things, about 4 or 5 years ago, it hadn't been done since, I think it was the 40s or 50s. And one of the reasons that I think that that's really important is because one of the things that they found in that study is that roughly 20% of the water that's flowing through the Colorado River at any one time is actually taken up and eaten, or quote unquote eaten, by the vegetation that's on the riverbeds of the river.
Yes,
you take this mm-hmm. assumption of, okay, well, there's this much water, and you immediately have to take off 20% mm-hmm. because of the vegetation. Mm-hmm. But in previous calculations, in previous numbers, in previous, ideations about how to manage this, that 20% was, okay, well, we have this available to allocate to where we want it. And so I think the reason I bring that up is because something you said earlier, it goes back to, unless you have good quality data and you have the good quality data from the right places, you are incapable of making decisions based on the data, because if you're making decisions based on flawed data, Exactly. Inherently, you're going to have flawed decisions.
Exactly.
Right? And so I think what you're talking about is you really have to start from square one of what is the resource that we actually have mm-hmm. available, mm-hmm. and then work backwards from there of the mm-hmm. allocation and how to get to a place where you have all the stakeholders that are, again, going back to this aligned incentives idea. And I don't think it's as sort of pie in the sky as people make it seem. I think it just really takes a measured approach of making sure the data that you're getting is good quality data. And so going back to the court case we were talking about, the Cactus Waters versus COG, I think, for the sake of brevity, for folks that may not be aware, what that court case is essentially on a Supreme Court in the federal level deciding right now who owns not necessarily the produced water, but the pore space where that produced water sits. And without getting too deep into the details, why that is important is because we didn't, up until relatively recently, realize that not only is there water being produced, but in that water, there are critical minerals that now have intrinsic inherent value, like lithium and some other minerals that are being extracted. And so in years past, it wasn't really a contention point. It wasn't really a source
Nobody
of conversation
really wanted it.
Around the landowners and operators of this water, because something needed to be done with it. And so who wants that responsibility? Now that conversation has fundamentally shifted over into, okay, well, there's a lot of stuff in that water. Who owns it? Who's managing it? You know, when it comes out a hole, mm-hmm. and that goes to what we were talking about previously about the contracts. Previously, oil and gas contracts may not have even addressed these things.
Right,
the oil and gas contracts that you're signing today and that you're seeing mm-hmm. today are explicitly mentioning things like lithium and these other things. And so, again, going back to the aligned incentives and sort of how do you manage this process, I think it takes a process of where you really have to start from square zero, get all the data, and then the things like the New Mexico Produced Water Consortium, Texas Produced Water Consortium, those consortiums, what they're focused on is that sort of that new wave of how do you manage this resource and bring everyone together with that backdrop of that stewardship and making sure that the resource is being protected.
Yeah. Out here on the Texas Plains, water is everything, and there's a resource that's as vital as it is fragile, our Playa Lakes. These lakes are nature's reservoir, catching rainwater to recharge our aquifer and provide lifelines for wildlife. But now they need our help. In collaboration with the Texas Playa Lakes Conservation Initiative and the Cargill Global Water Challenge, Sarah has started the Our Legacy is Tomorrow's Water Initiative to inspire and work with landowners to restore and protect our Playa Lakes. Each playa we save helps secure a sustainable water future for the generations that will be coming after us. Whether it's improving soil health, restoring habitats, or recharging groundwater, we are committed to making a difference. Together, we can build a legacy that we can all be proud of. To learn how you can join in, visit the Playa Lakes Restoration Initiative page on the SARA website. Let's keep Texas water flowing strong for the future. Visit sara-conservation.com.
So just for our listeners' sake, one of the reasons why they're calling this new water is because it was water that was not really accessible until we were able to frack. That new technology made oil that is in very small pore surfaces, I mean, like minuscule, like I can remember the first time hearing about fracking and someone saying it's like sucking it out of this table. It's basically that. So that's the reason why there's no place. You can't just say, we'll just put it back, because you don't just put it back in those little tiny places, right? So that's the reason why it's new water, and that's the reason why it can't go back to where it came from.
In addition to that, in the process of extracting it and it coming out of the ground, what's in that water and the salinity of that water and other things changes. And so you theoretically can put it back into the reservoir, but by doing that, if you're not marrying the exact biochemistry and what's in the water, you're going to fundamentally change the aquifer. And I'm not going to prognosticate good or bad, etc., but you are fundamentally changing it, mm-hmm. and that's mm-hmm. inarguable. And so I think, again, mm-hmm. if you're looking at the stewardship, I think that conversation, and we don't necessarily need to go there today, but I think that conversation sort of naturally leads into one of the other sort of hot button and topics, you know, topics of today, of the carbon capture. Because now, you know, when you remove that rock and remove that water and remove all the stuff that was in that reservoir.
And when we mean reservoir, we're not talking about like a big old swimming pool under the ground. We are not talking about that, just so people understand. We're talking about rock.
Right. The way I like to describe it is, if you thought about a massive sand, you know, like the sand pit that you see at a playground,
yes.
and in that there was highly dense, very compacted rock in there.
Yes.
You're talking about basically that under, you know, 10,000 feet under the ground that has enormous pressures on it. Because mm-hmm. One of the things I don't think we've talked about yet is the pressure that you're dealing with as mm-hmm. well. And that, all these things are now, mm-hmm. again, now, are now important that, 10 years ago, I don't even know if people were talking about it.
No, they weren't. Well, and what you're talking about impacting the aquifer is that these things have been there in the quote aquifer, but they're there in a way that they're contained and not contaminating, or maybe they're filtered out in such a way, the water is moving in such a way so slowly that it's filtering. But when you're getting it out in a concentrated level and then you're putting it back in a concentrated level, that's the concern. And that injection back into the ground, that's what people say it's fracking, that's causing, it's actually the water that we're injecting back into the ground that's causing this, the earthquakes and the shifting and the seismic. And I know we were recently at the Society of Petroleum Engineers, their produced water conference, and they were discussing about how, generally it's been thought that it's that, deep injection that's making the problem. But now they're speculating that actually it's maybe more the shallow that's causing some of this.
To put it into terms that I think anybody can understand, think about it this way. There's rock that's pressing on other rock that has enormous pressures on it, and you're introducing what basically boils down to soapy water. There's a ton of other things in it, but the viscosity of that water generally is like soapy water. And so, what would you think would happen if you lubricate two highly pressurized areas that are rock?
With salt, with soap.
Right. Yeah. This is not a super complicated equation when you sort of boil it down to those basics. And so I think it's inarguable that there is a linkage between seismicity and oil and gas activity and the water, et cetera. But going back to one of the things that I think people maybe have been scared off in the past is, I remember growing up, so again, to put a finer point on it or to orient with timeline, mid-30s, I remember growing up and hearing about blaring in my face as a kid, peak oil, and we're going to run out of oil, and oil, we're not going to have oil anymore.
Yes.
And then magically, a few years later, they found some technological innovation that completely changed that. And then, people started talking about peak oil again back around about that 10, 15 years ago. It came back. And so I think there's sort of this inherent optimism that, it'll figure itself out. I've been hearing about peak oil all these years, and we figured that one out. I just sort of wonder out loud to you, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, but I wonder out loud if water is maybe the first time that is not the case. Not going to be able to break the, we found new water and now it's no longer a problem. That's not on the docket as far as I'm concerned. Is that?
Yeah, no, but I have had actually people even on the podcast say that like they were like, oh, don't worry about it. There'll be another innovation come along. You know what I mean? And so I do think that people kind of see, environmentalism as Chicken Little. The sky's falling, the sky's falling. The sky's never fallen. And so it's never going to fall, And really we're just like, maybe the whole sky's not going to fall, but part of the sky might fall.
I think it's up to, folks like you and I to sort of tell the story of, and if anyone's listening to this and can think about it in this way, we figured out a long time ago how to move, for instance, crude oil distances for really cheap. And we figured that one out.
Right.
To put a very specific fine point on it, doing that with water is not possible. It flat out is, it's not a money allocation thing. It's not, we need a new process. It just flat out is not possible to move that large amount of water consistently through pipeline long distances. It's just not feasibly possible. And so I think this idea that, oh, we can fix it, it's baked in this, oh, well, we can move the water wherever we need it. But that's not baked in reality.
Yeah.
And so I think that we need a different way to approach it.
So Robert Mace, you know who Robert Mace is? Hilarious. We were at a water meeting. He did a talk on the history of water pipelines into Texas. It was so good. And the funny one, he would show the different, like, all kinds of different graphics. But the funniest one was a cowboy and a guy that was skiing and a guy in a sombrero. And they all had their straws in this lake. And it was when they were talking about bringing it in from the Great Lakes. And it said on the back of it, "Back off, suckers." So it was the point being like, we might, you know, even if we could, you still have this whole social aspect of people going, well, you can't have our water, you know?
And I think it also, one of the other things I wanted to bring up that I think is really important in this conversation is, I think that water has started to become a much more recognized topic of conversation, let's call it, on a global scale. And I think that one of the things that I think about a lot, actually, in sort of what can the United States maybe be doing differently or better is, and I don't know how widely this is known, but South Korea has had an initiative where they actually now have a beer. It's called New Water Beer that is made with produced water from industries that they have, domestically. And so they have found a way. And like when I think about, if you were to see, a beer on the shelf of HEB and on it were to say, made with produced water, I think most people would immediately put it down and go to something else because of that sort of inherent fear of what's in that and am I drinking?
Right.
And I think we grew up in the last couple of decades, you've seen all of this sort of, the fracking, I'm going to drink frack fluid and like all of the sort of hysteria around sort of things.
Right,
I think people sort of get lost in, okay, what actually is possible? What can we really do with this? And I bring that up because when you talk about beneficial reuse, when you talk about reintroducing this water into other streams, it's already being done on the globe. It's already being done at
We're
scale.
Once again, behind the times.
Right. I think we need to, as a people or whatever you want to call it, we need to get to a place where we're more inviting of that sort of new innovation. And that comes from the education, going back to what we talked about.
Exactly.
It comes from the education of what's in the water, how is it produced, et cetera. And I think you lose people when, good, bad, or indifferent in this industry, you have a lot of companies dealing with chemicals that are largely the same, but they have it through, okay, well, it's private because it's ours, and it's this proprietary blend that we don't want to give visibility to. And if you have a lot of that, people that might be drinking that water, I'm not going to give my kid that because of, I need to know
What's in it. Right, exactly. Well, and, I've heard, a statement that, like, we can clean it. Is it cost effective? No, does it matter? But at the end of the day, it's the fact that there will be enough salt to fill the AT&T Stadium every 13 days from this produced water. Just what we're producing now, not in 10 years when we're producing five times the amount of what we're producing right now. So that is the problem. What are they doing with the byproduct, with the what people might think of as the waste stream? I always think of that's got to be another market. That's another market. There's no waste stream. There's a market.
So I think it's actually what you just said. There are markets that have been developed for those different resources, for the stuff that's coming out of the water, for the water itself. I mean, again, we talked about it earlier. I mean, we live in a country where water is treated as this ubiquitous free resource that I don't need to pay for it. It's available whenever I need it. And I think that might be the flip that needs to switch before we really make these quantum leaps that we're talking about. Because if we started to realize that water is it's a zero-sum game, in the sense of, if I'm using a gallon of water to do X, that gallon of water is not being used to do Y.
Right.
And I think that there's a clear sort of delineation there that water, there are certain water streams that can be reused, like we're talking about beneficial reuse, but water does not duplicate in the way that some other,
And so somebody said it's like a Ponzi scheme. You can, but you're taking the same water and moving it over here, you know, but it's in the end, it's the same water. It's not new water, right? It's not, you're like, oh, now we have come up with this new water. No, we've just taken it from here and we've moved it here. And it's not back there anymore because we've moved it.
And again, going back to it, and it sounds like such a minute detail and a small issue, but at scale, it's a massive problem. When you look purely at the amount of water that evaporates in the Permian Basin alone, just take the Permian Basin, forget the rest of the country for a second, just the evaporation power out of just that basin wastes or uses, whatever word you want to use, billions of gallons of water every single year, billions of gallons. And so, I mean, it's a massive issue at scale because, again, unless you have industry or unless you have a stakeholder at the table that wants to solve that problem, right, that problem's not going away.
Well, one of the projects we've been working on is Playa Lake restoration. And I think that's part of, you know, another issue here, you know, that when it rains, they're not functioning. About 85% of them don't function like they should, so they don't recharge. And that is, again, another, you know, balancing act of present and the future. How do we incentivize the people in the present to preserve and to restore those? And that's one of the things that we're looking at. We've won the Global Water Challenge from Cargill, which I always tell people, if you win a Global Water Challenge, that is not necessarily good. Not being bad. I mean, it's a, you know, something that Cargill's interested in is like, hey, if we pay for the restoration of this, would you participate? You know, and we were at the Emerald Farm Show because I really wanted to get it. I mean, I know I could get 50 playas from just family members, you know what I mean? Like just fast because there's so many, but I wanted a good sense of like, how would people respond to that? Mm-hmm. And of course, very positively. You know, and so it does show, you know, that there are ways to incentivize people. If you ask people, will you spend your own money to do this? It'll be a different story because some people would seriously want to do that and just don't have the ability to do it. Or people just, it's not valuable enough to them to spend the money to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm cautiously optimistic that some of the things that we're seeing at the federal and state levels are going to fundamentally change that. You know, in the Inflation Reduction Act of 2021 or 2022, there was $4 billion that was allocated to essentially studying the Rio Grande water system and making improvements is the short version. And there's other initiatives that, you know, that are along those lines. You also, like we talked about, you have these state consortiums that are working really diligently on creating that roadmap that we're talking about here. And you know, it's been really encouraging that the EPA has been what I qualify as a active participant in those conversations. And it has at least to date been really supportive of those changes being sort of driven by the other stakeholders rather than just putting out a roadmap of here's the blueprint, follow it. There's been some really good, what I qualify as sort of back and forth conversation.
Yeah, I've seen that too. And I know EPA was even, you know, not long ago saying, hey, we want this to be used for ag. So come on, y'all, tell us how it needs to be regulated. I mean, that's pretty unusual.
Very. And I think it points to the complexity of the issue. I mean,
it does.
I don't know. It does. But between the folks in this room, I don't know how many things we could point to that the government has said, hey, industry or people that know this, help us find the regulations that work. And we're being given that opportunity as a industry. And I think it's really important that mm-hmm. we take that full force because that, again, goes back to the PR of this and sort of how it's being managed, that if we're being given a voice of, you know, what we can do, I argue that the folks in our industry that are focused on this issue are probably the smartest in the world at that. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. if they have a mm-hmm. good quality, if they have a seat at the table, that's a net benefit.
For everybody. that's one of the benefits of capitalism is that you're bringing together the people that will benefit from that. They have vested interest in making sure it works. And that, you know, the more we can lean into that, the better. But so before we go, I'd like for you to tell us some about the Produced Water Society and what y'all do. I know you're the president of that organization,
vice president
of the organization. So tell us, it's an international organization. What all do you do and who's involved? And
absolutely. Yeah. So the Produced Water Society is a 501c3 based out of Austin, Texas. We are focused on really bringing a lot of the conversation that we're having today to the forefront, but mostly focused on the technical process side of the business. And so that's, you know, most of the conferences and meetings that we have are attended by engineers and folks on the ground that are actually doing the work and the scientists and researchers and the mm-hmm. people sort of behind the the technical side of the processes that are getting us to where we, you know, where we need to be. Domestically, we have two events every year. We have one in August in the Permian Basin in Midland that's focused just on the Permian, and we have one in February that's in Houston, Texas, that's much more global. We have an offshore and an onshore track, and that's I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but it, that conference is going to be coming up soon, actually. It's February 10th to 13th of 2025 in Houston, and so we'd love to see some folks there. You know, I think it's an interesting blend of people that, you know, it is highly technical and highly focused on the process side, but there is, I don't know if there's a better place to sort of learn what's being done in the field and what's working and what's not working than that conference. And then internationally, we have, right now we have two on the calendar, but you know, in a few months that number may balloon up to four or five. We're working with a couple of under other regions to bring some conferences or some attention there. But we currently have two in the Middle East this year. I believe we had one in Qatar and one in Saudi Arabia, and that's you know, generally we have two in that region. But we're also looking to expand into Southeast Asia. We're actually going to be having a conference in at the end of February in Nigeria, alongside the Nigeria International Energy Summit. We're going to have a produced water track there as well. And so I think that also points to that this is not only a domestic issue, this is a global issue. And I don't know if there's a I don't know if there's a corner on the globe that's not dealing with this and or hasn't woken up to this already, which
is
good to see.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Well, that's important work. And it's great that it's getting started here in Texas, you know, and feel like we lead the way sometimes. Sometimes we're not the leaders in issues of environmental importance, though, and I think I'm happy to see, you know, the people that were kind of leading the way in this whole, you know, updating our oil and gas energy, the energy waste laws, are like, there are people in that space, you know, producers in that space, and when the regulations are so low, then, you know, people think you're falling to that level, you know, when a lot of companies, and I know I've heard people say before, you know, those oil and gas companies, hey, nobody made us start doing this. You know, we're looking at the future. We're looking forward. We know that there has to be a lot of energy, and it's going to need to come from all kinds of sources, and any source that, you know, is viable.
Yeah, I know. I think it's the classic issue with something at this scale. You know, when something breaks and something breaks disastrously, everyone on the planet hears about it. When you go, you know, however many millions of operations or thousands of operations you know, in a row with it working perfectly, nobody hears about that. And so again, that kind of goes back to the PR of the process. And I think it's really challenging because when you start to talk about, and even today, I stopped myself a couple of times, before going down into sort of what would be really technical speak and sort of down the rabbit hole, because I think the problem of the industry, and when I say industry, I'm not just talking about oil and gas. I think industry at large, when you talk about water management, the average person doesn't understand that, doesn't have any idea what that takes, what that means. And that can be as simple as if you were to ask the average American, you know, how their municipal water is treated when it goes to the treatment plant. Very few are going to have any clue at all, much less a cogent answer to that. And I think that just goes back to it's a boring topic at the end of the day, but it's so important that we need to find ways to bring this to the forefront so that the average person can understand this.
Yes.
Because if we leave it to sort of the wills that be, there's a lot of scare tactics and a lot of bad information.
Right.
There's a lot of things you can talk about that aren't accurate, et cetera, that if you have those stakeholders, you know, they want to be involved. They want to feel like they have the ability to be a part of the conversation.
Right.
And we as an industry, I think, need to take the brunt of getting those folks to the table.
I totally agree. I totally agree. And I think that people, you know, we need to continue to encourage just, you know, people like us, average citizens, to be educated, you know, educate yourself on these things and make certain that's available and accessible to people. And unfortunately, there's so many avenues of getting information to people that it's so hard to know, like, which avenue is the best avenue. And it costs money to produce things and to get things out there, you know. And so that's why it takes a lot of collaboration across industries and stakeholders to get things like this moving. And I'm really grateful that you would drive to Lubbock early in the morning and come and visit with us.
I really appreciate the time. And the, you know, the last thing I'll say to that specifically is that, you know, if you're listening to this and you happen to live in Texas, you're in an incredibly advantageous position that I would imagine probably right in your backyard is the water district that your Absolutely. Area is managed by. Mm-hmm. And that can be a really good place to just mm-hmm. start this conversation and start the, if you want to go down the rabbit hole of learning a little bit more, go, you know, go to some of those Absolutely. Meetings. There's a lot of hearings and there's a lot of open public record things that you can, mm-hmm. you can start to get mm-hmm. the firsthand knowledge, whereas other countries, you know, other states don't necessarily have that set up. And so I think that, you know, we're in a place where yeah, if you want to be involved, you can really sort of become as involved as you want to be.
And well, that's really true. And to that point, we'll add in our notes that our local water districts link to their website because there's some great information there. And they also, you know, will come and do, you know, education events and all kinds of things to help people. So, Ben, thanks again.
Thank you for the time. Really, really appreciate the conversation.
It was great. It was great. And friends, thanks for joining us again. I hope you enjoyed this. I don't know how you couldn't. It was really super interesting. And I hope that you will utilize this information to do what's right for us right now and for in the future too. And as always, it's helpful to us if you will like and share the podcast. That's like almost the same as making a financial contribution. It's really helpful. So we look forward to being with you again next time on Conservation Stories.